South of the railroad tracks that run through downtown Tallahassee is the predominantly black area known as South City, or more broadly as the South Side.
We interviewed 21 elders from the community, South Side communities. And one from Appalachian Ridge in particular stood out when he talked about the wall of Appalachian Ridge. It was a physical barrier that said, don't come in, to the folks on the other side. So Appalachian Ridge was the white community. South City was the black community. It did not provide an inviting environment.
Rachel Bassan Porter helps organize the annual Soul of Southside Arts and Humanities Festival.
On this side of the tracks, where we're standing right now at Lake Anita, was the black side of town. Over in downtown and up in the north side, that was the white side of town. So the train tracks were an artificial barrier, a physical barrier, I should say, that separated black from white and white from black.
Poet Cynthia Rose is biracial, and she's lived on both sides of the tracks.
Yeah, when I moved to Tallahassee, I thought, oh, I'm going to be in the capital city. Yeah. It will be progressive. And then I got to Tallahassee and I was like, wow, this is like the deep South. I could feel the tension between black and white racial divide. I could feel the tension. It wasn't that anyone like was overtly racist, but you feel it.
Tom Miller and his wife have lived in Tallahassee for a couple of years. We found them sitting near the festivities at the plaza. Miller weighed in on the negative connotations associated with living on the perceived wrong side of the tracks.
I had a lady say to me last Sunday in church, and I think she's really true, she says it's because we have an inherent humanity of lack of acceptance of people that don't look like us. And I never thought about it that way. I'd never put it in those terms, but I think she's got some insight.
This is my neighborhood. You know, this is, it's only called wrong because people recognize that the wrong that's been done to it.
Southside resident Christique Henry wears a lot of hats, including real estate business owner and community advocate. She's also an organizer of the Soul of Southside Festival.
There's a positive story there because despite the wrong that is done in the past, folks over here have found a way. They have found a way to care for one another. They found a way to make a way for children to get to FAMU and to graduate with degrees so that the next generation can experience that higher level of attainment that comes with educational attainment. They've made a way to be able to buy and afford homes over here. We haven't told the story of this side of town.
All around the city, alive, awake, and oh, so busy. Do you long for a place where we can see the butterflies dance among the trees? Where we can pause our tasks for a while and breathe, release, take in a smile? Where we can sit and meditate or read a book and contemplate on what gives meaning to our souls? Collective dreams uniting the whole.
Poet Cynthia Rose wrote of the joy in a Southside park a few years ago with A Poem for Our Community. She read the poem at the unveiling of improvements to the Orange Meridian community space.
Where children park their bikes to play, there's such a place for us here today. A place for all the ages, the young and the sages. Come. Sit a while and be at ease in this space we call our community.
In May of 2022, the Progressive Policy Group, the Century Foundation, released a study on school resegregation. The results mirror the findings of a 2017 report from Florida State University's Leroy Collins Institute. Both of these studies, done 5 years apart, found that Leon County schools are the most segregated they've been since 1994. The Collins study included another mic drop moment. It said students who attend Leon County schools are in one of the most highly segregated school districts in the entire state.
How did you feel when you first saw that report come out?
I would like to say I was surprised, but I really wasn't.
Leanne County School Superintendent Rocky Hanna says what's happening in his district schools is reflected across Tallahassee.
Unfortunately, I think part of it is, as a community in Leon County, we've become segregated, and our neighborhoods have become more segregated than ever.
But the reasons for that are complicated. One reason is that people move and things change. That's a part of life. Another reason is opportunity. Federal laws like the Fair Housing Act of 1968 eliminated discrimination in housing. And for the first time, non-white people could live wherever they wanted, as long as they could afford it. And many began to move into neighborhoods that had previously been segregated. The result? Many predominantly white neighborhoods and schools that existed before 1975, they eventually became predominantly and then majority black by the late 1980s and early 1990s.
It has, and it's, again, shifted drastically over the course of the last decade or so. Unfortunately, Lynn, it's called what it is. Some white families, they don't want their kids going to school with black children or schools that are predominantly black.
But it's not just race that's driving the divisions. Complicating the issue has been the introduction of school choice, no longer limiting families to the schools they're zoned for. Today, families have far more options: public school, private school, charter school, or even homeschool. And what started off as an effort to help disabled or poor kids in failing Florida public schools has grown to the point where even higher-income families can get money to send their children to schools outside of the district. How people view the impact of desegregation is still a focal point for discussion, and so is the issue of resegregation. I sat down with Dr. Andrea Oliver of TCC to talk more about the language of these conversations and how we have them.
And one of the first questions and one of the first issues that we have come across is asking about whether resegregation is the right term for what we are presently seeing. And if it is not a resegregation, did desegregation ever happen? And so I want to start there by sort of exploring these words and what they mean and if they ever actually fully materialized.
So it's a pleasure to be with you here on this podcast, and I'm really glad that we are using semantics as a starting point. And I submit to you, and this may surprise some of your listeners, that, well, it depends on what your idea or what your meaning of resegregation is, because to say that we resegregated seems to somehow suggest that there was a period where we were not segregated. And frankly, I don't know that we've ever had that. By that, this I mean, we never really integrated. If you were to look up the term integration in any standard dictionary, the meaning that you will get for that word is one that suggests total incorporation, total involvement and enveloping of various components that meld together in a harmonious sort of a way. That isn't what happened.
What happened, says Oliver, is that after it became obvious Leon County schools would have to desegregate, some parents looked for new ways to avoid it. In 1970, the district wrote a memo letting parents know they could take their white children out of their newly desegregated local school. And other parents went further. They put their kids into highly segregated, all-white private schools.
It's a shout to the whole land. No land is home to the spirit. We are divine beings God made and made to mirror it. We all free. There's no such thing as aliens when the whole damn planet was made for we. Governments and politicians create boundaries, but not the outer limits. That's outside your jurisdiction.
According to a recent study from the University of Massachusetts, black farmers lost $326 billion worth of acreage during the last century. For perspective, in 1900, black farmers owned 14% of agricultural land. Today, that figure is down to 0.5%.
In a capitalistic society, land is extremely valuable. It's critical to generational wealth transfer.
Dr. Sandra Thompson is a researcher at Florida A&M University. By the early 20th century, former enslaved people were looking to land to start building wealth and secure their economic and social future.
So by 1910, formerly enslaved people had amassed over 15 million acres of land. It was based on buying a little bit at a time, maybe some being given a little bit at a time.
As of the most recent USDA census of agricultural lands in 2017, that figure drops to 4.5 million acres. Losing ownership of land is a significant economic loss, but that land was also part of communities that supported and protected their members through tough times, from slavery through segregation. Thompson calls those communities legacy communities.
A legacy community is a community that was started on plantations pre-emancipation. Some were started right after emancipation, but in both instances, they are still viable, live communities where people live.
Thompson has identified dozens of these communities in a 5-county stretch of the Florida Panhandle, from Madison to Jackson County.
One of the things is that in order to survive the conditions of slavery, you had to organize yourself in a way that you could take care of yourself, your family, and those you love.
Not all of these communities have made it into the 21st century. For many, all that's left are the cemeteries. Some, like Smoky Hollow, were lost to eminent domain, but many have been eroded due to the loss of individual parcels that have been carved up and sold off to developers, thus erasing them from history.
The Federation of Southern Cooperatives and other researchers have identified Ayers property as the primary reason.
So what happened a lot of the time is, say your grandmother or grandfather had actually purchased the property. A lot of the time, it could have been property they were enslaved on.
Billy Ventimiglia is a graduate student at Florida State University. She's the senior planner of the North Star Legacy Community Project, which is a collaboration between Sandra Thompson and FSU.
If me and, say, Ashton, Chloe, and Howard were siblings, and my parents or my grandmother died, and they passed it on to us, we might not have had a formalized will. So the way that happens is now we're kind of all joint property owners. If we don't agree on what to do to the property, be that to create a trust or to sell or keep it, one of us could go to court. And the judge could then decide all four of us have to sell if Howard wants to sell. So that's how we ended up losing a lot of that property that was owned by Black people.
Through the FAMU Cooperative Extension, Sandra Thompson offers workshops to help people hold on to their land by educating them on the legal structures surrounding the ownership of property. Yet, while a better understanding of the law could prevent further loss of Black land, it can't bring back what's already gone. Both in the city and in the country, people of color have lost communities or seen them radically altered, and many people have lost touch with their agricultural roots. At the same time Black land loss was being felt in the 20th century, Black communities began to see a rise in health problems such as diabetes, high blood pressure, and obesity, all diseases that are food-related. In 2012, a group of community leaders and youth volunteers tried to reestablish their connection to the land in a new form, the community garden.
I was planting it on this planet.
I was planting it on this planet.
From a seed like a tree.
From a seed like a tree.
You can see it in my roots.
You can see it in my roots.
I got melanin in me.
I got melanin in me.
The world is immersed in a global pandemic. I'm not talking about a virus, it's a little more systemic. History has shown us all the battles we fought. We march, we sing, we dance, and we boycott when we have to fight for our human rights. When we're afraid to walk the streets at night. When we're scared of getting pulled over because we're not white. How are we expected to just be all right? I'm tired of embracing all these dreams, hypotheticals. People saying quiet, embrace the parentheticals. Equality for all cannot be theoretical. So we'll keep marching on when they tell us to let it go. That's the price we pay, fighting for justice. Some days it's a crowd, other days it is just us. But we keep moving forward, do what we must, and all the while we will have to trust.
58 years after the Federal Civil Rights Act was passed, there's a new front opening in the ongoing battle for civil rights. This is a war of words.
I have the honor and privilege of introducing the combatant of critical race theory, a champion for parental rights, and our warrior for Florida. Ladies and gentlemen, please stand to your feet for the best governor in the nation, Governor Ron DeSantis!
It's December of 2021, and Governor Ron DeSantis is introducing a new bill he plans to push through the legislative session. He calls it the Stop Woke Act. It codifies a new rule from the State Department of Education that bans discussions about critical race theory in public K-12 schools.
And this will do a number of things that are very important. One, it will put into statute the Department of Education's prohibition on CRT in K-12 schools. No taxpayer dollars should be used to teach our kids to hate our country or to hate each other.
During the 2022 legislative session, lawmakers passed the bill. It puts restrictions on how issues of race and history can be discussed in public school classrooms and workplaces. The legislation itself does not directly mention critical race theory, a concept that examines how racism has influenced government policy. But it's clear that was a driving factor in the governor's support of the new law. Throughout committee hearings on the measure, lawmakers, including Democrats Trey McCurdy, Fentress Driscoll, Ramon Alexander, and Patricia Williams, fought back.
We as a legislature have told Floridians, you can't protest. You can't pass out water at precincts. You can't play high school sports if you're transgender. Now we're coming to tell you to don't say gay, don't unionize. And in this committee with this bill, we're trying to tell you to don't tell your history. Don't tell your perspective of what you think history is.
There's been a narrative this session where we're suppressing stories, suppressing the stories of women and not considering their lives in context when it comes to that 15-week abortion ban, suppressing the stories and lived experiences of our LGBTQ+ youth and families with the Don't Say Gay bill. And now we're suppressing history and the stories and lived experience, particularly of Black people.
If all these issues didn't matter, we wouldn't have this bill. If race didn't matter, and this stuff didn't poll well to get people to come out and vote and cause a dadgum insurrection, we wouldn't have these type of bills.
One of my colleagues said we're confused about what we're saying. There's no confusion about this. This is disappointing. This is disgusting for the state of Florida. Our history, it happened, and we can't take it back.
The study of race and racism has always involved language, and specifically the public use of language, and what does racism sound like, right? What is the vernacular of racism?
Davis Houck is a professor of rhetorical studies at Florida State University. He says the language of racism finds its way into political speech, where it's used as a dog whistle to try to influence specific groups.
And by dog whistle, this is simply a fancy way of saying only certain people hear it in very particular ways, right? It's a term loaded with meaning that only a certain group is going to hear.
What repeatedly struck Black lawmakers was the language itself, clearly aimed at tamping down discussions of issues associated with the nation's record of enslavement and civil rights because of concerns white people might feel uncomfortable.
Who doesn't want to be awake?
DeSantis's effort to turn a word prevalent in Black vernacular, the word woke, into a weapon was a pointed shot, and won Black lawmakers, local officials, and Black academics, like Tallahassee Community College history professor Andrea Oliver, heard loud and clear.
I mean, what does that word really mean in its non-vernacular, in the non-vernacular sense? It means to be enlightened. It means to be tolerant. It means to be aware. Who doesn't want to be those things? So, like, call me woke. Yeah, I absolutely am. Because what's the alternative? What is the opposite of woke? Sleep?
Nicole Patton-Terry is the director of the Florida Center for Reading Research at Florida State University. She says this isn't the first time a word from Black creators has been turned against them. And it won't be the last.
We have had a tendency to use that piece of who Black people are in ways that are negative in ways that actually promote other people, but not us, in ways that can be harmful and damaging. And how can we just stop it? Can we just cut that out? And I think the real answer to that question has to do with whether or not we're ever going to get over this racism thing.
Pat and Terry thinks it's necessary for all parts of American history to be remembered so society can understand what drives the way Black people are treated today.
It's not like we're out here having a slavery party and just want to talk about it all day because it was so much fun. But the heart, we want to talk about the celebration just as much as we want to talk about the things that were horrible because they matter.
We got brothers and sisters getting locked up in jail, fighting for better days and they can't make bail, willing to get locked up so that we can be free, because it's the vision that them and Dr. King all see, that we work together, pray together, struggle together, go to jail together so that we can be free together. Doesn't matter if it's tomorrow or forever, we will find our pen and we will write our letter. Come on. We must believe as we fight on, that victory and justice can be won.
There's gonna be a
A praise and worship service on a Sunday afternoon in June kicked off Tallahassee's second annual Soul of the Southside Festival. And co-organizer Karen Gillespie, she made sure to represent her Southside roots.
I'm Southside born, I'm Southside bred, and Lord willing, I'll be here till I'm Southside dead.
After the festival kickoff, Gillespie explained why a church was the perfect place for the Arts and Cultural Festival to get underway.
It's been our education place. It's been our political movement place. It's been our family gathering place. It's been places where we go to celebrate the homegoing of our families. So that church is just the heart of who we are, because that was the only place we could meet and be who we are. And so the church has been, is the focus of our community.
The Black Church has historically served as a refuge for Black Americans living in a racially oppressive society. And it's been a safe haven for centuries, says local singer Anita Franklin.
And so the church is what kept us. It's that corporate gathering that you come together and sing songs of Zion. But it's to edify, not only to give praise to God, but we edify one another, because it's those trying times that the community, Black community, has experienced, those times of racism.
During a televised interview on NBC's Meet the Press in 1960, Martin Luther King Jr. said, quote, "I think it is one of the tragedies of our nation, one of the shameful tragedies, that 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is one of the most segregated hours, if not the most segregated hour, in Christian America."
That statement is challenging the sort of American Christian churches to live up to those central precepts or those central ideas of Christianity, maybe through the moral exemplary life of Jesus the Christ.
Jamil Drake was a professor of religion at Florida State University and is now a faculty member of the Divinity School at Yale University.
In some ways, race or whiteness still governs how people orient themselves religiously.
As I walk along this way, troubles and trials cloud my day.
More than 60 years after King called for church integration, Black and white churchgoers still worship separately. A Lifeway research survey of pastors taken in 2021 shows 76% of church congregations have one dominant racial group.
You'll be my strength, is what I heard.
Some African Americans are leaving Black churches, but other racial groups aren't joining predominantly Black churches at the same rate. Historically Black-led churches are also facing another challenge, the departure of younger adults, especially millennials and Gen Zers. I'm your host, Valerie Crowder, and this is Not So Black and White, A Community's Divided History, brought to you by WFSU Public Media.
That I cannot see.